Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another episode of Ribba Resistance. So I will be driving this episode mainly. And today we have a very special guest. We have with us Mando, who goes by the pen name of Ashiq Osman, who recently published the first children's book for Muslims talking about Bitcoin, and is called Bitcoin is Halal. So we have a bunch of questions we're going to ask about the book, but today we'll also be talking about some other topics as well. So Mando, feel free to introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about yourself.
Wa alaikum salam, and thank you for having me on Ribba Resistance. Great to be here with you and the team. Thank you. My name is Ashiq Osman, though you can find me on Telegram under the pseudonym Mando or at Ami Satoshi. I'm based in London. My background is in computer science. I'm a former programmer developer, and I'm an enterprise IT solutions architect by profession with nearly 30 years experience in the industry, alhamdulillah. I'm an independent author, artist and publisher. I recently launched my imprint, Ashiq Osman Books, with the vision of creating culturally resonant children's stories and educational resources. This year, I wrote and published Bitcoin is Halal, Adam and Layla Discover Digital Gold. It's the world's first children's book introducing Muslim families to Bitcoin in a way that connects technology with ethical and Islamic values.
Yeah, so I will say for me personally, when you published your children's book, I thought it was really, really awesome, because a lot of the times when I'm trying to orange pill other Muslims, we run into this problem inevitably, is that like a lot of Muslims and a lot of people in general just don't read books. But publishing a children's book, I feel like, is a lot easier introduction, not because, you know, we think everyone is so stupid that they're only going to be reading a children's book, but it actually gives them an introduction where, okay, they may not read a whole book like the Bitcoin Standard, but at least they may get a book for their kids to talk about and learn about Bitcoin. So I thought that was like a very good kind of middle path instead of publishing a full-blown book. So my first question to you, Mando, is what made you decide to end up writing a children's book for Muslims about Bitcoin?
That's a great question, MV. Since I first heard about Bitcoin back in 2011, I've always wanted to write a Bitcoin book for the community. So alhamdulillah, I finally got that opportunity this year. So for me, the decision came from two directions. First, I saw that the Bitcoin conversation sort of often gets stuck in a very technical or academic level. So books like the Bitcoin Standard are brilliant, but they're not accessible to everyone, especially families who want to introduce these ideas to their children. And secondly, I wanted Muslims to see that Bitcoin isn't just about finance, that it's about values. And my goal was to create a faith-aligned introduction that sparks curiosity. So children's book felt like the right medium because it lowers the barrier to entry. So the book has been written in a highly accessible way with humor, family-oriented discussions, and in a style that's inspired by books such as A Diary of a Wimpy Kid and Zeynep Mian's Ilyas Explained series. So you could say that it's somewhat of a Trojan horse, in that once families see Bitcoin framed through ethics and storytelling, they can go deeper into the rabbit hole with technical books later. I mean, parents, you know, may not sit down to read a 400-page economics book, but they'll happily share a story with their kids. And during that process, they themselves get introduced to the concepts. But the first step is making it approachable, and that's what Bitcoin is Halal is designed to do. So I felt it was important to give them some history and context so that we can explain not just what or how Bitcoin, but why Bitcoin.
Yeah, that's great. And you know, I think one of the really good jobs that you do in the book is you actually explain Ribba and you explain it to children, because, you know, one of the things that I've noticed is that there's a lot of educational books for children about different topics in Islam. But conveniently, it seems like Ribba, I don't know of any children's book for Muslims that talks about Ribba. And to be honest, Mando, I think yours is probably the first book that actually tackles that subject. So I think that's really phenomenal in that aspect. And actually, I've been reading the book to my 7-year-old, and alhamdulillah, he's actually been digesting a lot of the concepts in there. And it feels like the explanation you gave for Ribba was actually very easy to understand, especially for my 7-year-old. What I wanted to ask you is, as you're trying to explain a lot of the concepts around Bitcoin and fiat and Ribba, what topic do you think is the hardest to explain to a child?
Alhamdulillah, I'm really glad to hear that your 7-year-old was able to digest concepts like Ribba, because that was one of my biggest goals, to make something that parents and children could share together without it feeling overwhelming. In terms of difficulty, in my experience with discussions with my own kids, I'd say one of the hardest concepts to explain to my children is about fiat money. So not just what it is, but why it loses value over time. I mean, kids can grasp riba quickly because it's a moral story, like unfairness, taking more than you give. They understand that instinctively. Bitcoin is also easier to frame as digital gold or money that no one can cheat. But fiat money requires explaining inflation, central banks, why prices keep rising even though people are working hard. And that can be abstract for a child. So I had to use analogies like comic books or lollipops getting more expensive over time to show how value can disappear. So my approach was always to simplify without losing the ethical core. So if a child walks away understanding that riba is unfair, Bitcoin is transparent and fiat money is unstable, then I've planted those seeds for deeper learning later, inshallah.
Hey, Mando, Assalamu alaikum. T here. I had a question. So I haven't yet read your book, and my kids are, you know, my oldest is 5. So I think I got maybe a year or so before maybe she understands that. But I definitely want to get it and read it. But just to ask you, how did you explain the concept of riba in the book? Because I'm curious as to what that explanation looked like for myself and also for the audience who may not have read the book yet.
Wa alaikum salam. Great question, T. So when I set out to explain riba in the book, I wanted children to understand it not as like a complicated financial term, but as a simple story. So like kids naturally grasp the idea of fairness. So like if you lend £10 and someone demands £12 back, they know that's wrong. So in the book, riba is explained through the example of borrowing and lending. I frame it as taking more than you give or charging someone extra just because they're in need, like getting free money just for having money. So like wealth should come from genuine effort and trade. And that way children see riba as exploitation rather than just interest rates. And by simplifying it into moral language, kids can connect riba to values they already understand, like honesty, fairness, and kindness. And my goal was to plant that seed early. So when children grow older and encounter banking or fiat money, they already have a moral compass to guide them. I mean, we can't just tell our kids to avoid riba. We need to show them what sound, ethical money looks like. And my intention was to spark those crucial family conversations, like using a story that's both faithful and fun. So it's not just about riba. I mean, in the book, I talk about gharar, excessive uncertainty, and maisir, gambling, and how Bitcoin's features of being like decentralized with limited supply and transparency are aligned with Islamic finance principles.
And that's interesting that you say that because, you know, that's the part that a lot of Bitcoiners also don't understand sometimes, which is that Bitcoin is just a tool and it's a tool that can possibly be used for nefarious purposes. And actually, I even think that it's possible to, you know, create a fiat type system on top of Bitcoin. Perhaps it won't be as toxic as our current system, but it's certainly not impossible to do.
Yeah, definitely. One other question I have in talking about the book, as you're writing the book, was it obvious to you that a lot of these topics that you're going to be talking about to children, did you feel like you had to dumb them down a lot, or did you just try to explain them in a way where you basically assume that the kids will just naturally get it? I asked that because when I was, you know, reading the book to my kid, I was actually quite surprised that my 7-year-old was able to understand, oh, okay, this riba thing is not right. Like he just kind of instinctively knew that this riba concept is immoral and not right. And I didn't really have to explain it that much. But yeah, did you have to like dumb down a lot of the concepts for the book?
That's a really insightful point, Membi. I mean, I never wanted to dumb down the concepts because children are often much sharper than we give them credit for. And what I did instead was to try and translate complex ideas into stories and values that they already understand. For example, as I mentioned already, riba isn't explained with technical finance terms. It's framed as unfairness, taking more than you give, or exploiting someone in need. Kids instinctively recognize that as wrong. So rather than simplifying to the point of losing meaning, I leaned on analogies. I mean, moral language that children naturally connect with. So my philosophy was that children don't need watered down ideas. They need accessible framing. So if you respect their intelligence and give them relatable examples, they'll surprise you with how quickly they grasp concepts like fairness, scarcity, or transparency. And that's exactly what you saw with your seven-year-old. I mean, he didn't need a lecture. He just needed the story to click. So it's not so much as dumbing down, but rather easier to digest in this style, because we in the Bitcoin community know that Bitcoin is multifaceted. I mean, there's computer science, economics, electrical engineering, game theory, mathematics, and a form of applied cryptography. So the book is split into four parts with 17 chapters. The book is only 161 pages, but it does cover a lot of ground. Everything from the history of money, what is Bitcoin, how it works, the blockchain, mining, who invented it, Satoshi and Bitcoin's origins. It then goes into the Islamic perspective and talks about riba, gharar, maisir, and the family discussion goes into why Bitcoin is halal and the arguments for it. And we end up with a halal checklist. The book then covers some popular FUD and responds to those that effectively refutes them. It also talks about the important topic of real-world use cases of Bitcoin. And there's a bonus chapter as well at the end explaining why altcoins are a waste of money, full of scams and best left alone. I felt it was important to include that. And at the end of the book, there are worksheets and puzzles to test their understanding.
Yeah, I think you did a really great job actually like striking that balance. And honestly, like as I'm going through the book with my kid, I get surprised at where he gets stuck. Like, for example, I feel like you did a good job of making the identity of Satoshi very mysterious. But my seven-year-old was just like, but who is Satoshi? Where is he now? Like, he just could not fathom that like someone would just, you know, invent Bitcoin and just eat themselves off somewhere. So
Ramadan is a time of mercy, a time of giving. A time when every act of sadaqah carries multiplied reward. Right now, at Orphans of Uganda Children's Center, children who have lost everything are being cared for with love, shelter, and education. Your sadaqah this Ramadan can provide for ongoing needs, from daily food supplies, to school fees, to urgent medical care for illnesses like malaria. Your support makes a direct difference. And now, giving is easier than ever. You can donate instantly using Bitcoin or Lightning, fast, borderless, and direct, helping your sadaqa reach them without delay. To give today, send your sadaqa via Lightning to Orphans of Uganda at 8333.mobi. That's Orphans of Uganda at 8333.mobi. Orphans of Uganda Children's Center. Independently verified. Transparent updates, real impact. This Ramadan, let your sadaqa bring hope.
But yeah, how do you envision children will start adopting Bitcoin? Like, do you think the children are that are kind of growing up with Bitcoin being adopted, do you think they're the ones that are going to be mainly using this tech and building the tech that's going to be used for future generations? I mean, is that kind of like the direction that you think the children are going to be adopting Bitcoin?
Thanks, MB. That's a great observation. The mystery of Satoshi is one of those things that fascinates both adults and children, because kids naturally want to know who made this and where are they now. And I think that mystery actually adds to the magic of Bitcoin. It's not about one person anymore. It's about a global community. As for children adopting Bitcoin, I definitely don't see them as passive users waiting for adults to hand it down. Our kids are the next generation. The Gen Zs and the Gen Alphas are digital natives. Kids born after 2009 are Bitcoin era kids. So I believe they'll be the ones shaping the next wave of Bitcoin technology. Just like today's kids grow up fluent in smartphones and apps, tomorrow's kids will grow up fluent in wallets, Lightning payments, and decentralized tools. What excites me most is that children raised with Bitcoin stories like Bitcoin is halal won't see it just as money. They'll see it as part of their ethical framework, inshallah. They'll understand fairness, transparency, and scarcity from a young age. That means when they start building tech, they'll design it with those values in mind, inshallah. So yes, I do think the next generation will be the main drivers of Bitcoin adoption. They'll be the ones coding, innovating, and creating the platforms that future generations will use. Our role as parents and educators is simply to plant the seeds now, so they grow up with both the technical fluency and the ethical compass to use Bitcoin responsibly.
Right. I was just going to add just to your point. So, you know, in the past, right, 50, 60 years ago, what grandparents and parents used to do is buy government bonds. They used to buy those bonds, those $100 bonds or whatever they were, and they would store them over time and then be like, you know, when you go to college or you get older, you can cash this out, right? And that was what we want to build with Bitcoin, that type of mentality. Now, that was a time when government was a little bit more responsible with fiat, right? Therefore, it kind of worked at that time. Obviously, nobody does that anymore because over time, because of the dilution of money, that concept itself became kind of silly, right? So what we're seeing now is sort of that return to the responsible savings, right? Because what we should expect is by the time our kids are older, by the time they are, you know, in adulthood, they're going to likely be living under a Bitcoin standard. So what this is building essentially is this idea of saving, this idea of thinking long-term, longer time preference versus short-time preference. So I think it's very important to instill in children.
I completely agree, T. What you described with government bonds, or rather using perhaps a more appropriate example of gold, is exactly the mentality that I think we'd like to instill and revive in young people today. The idea of saving for the future with something that holds its value. In the past, bonds worked because fiat was relatively stable. But over time, inflation eroded that trust. Bitcoin brings back that long-term savings mindset, but in a way that's incorruptible. When children grow up hearing stories about Bitcoin, they're not just learning about money. They're learning about patience, responsibility, and thinking beyond instant gratification. They'll see Bitcoin as a tool of low time preference. It trains us to think long-term. And for those of us blessed with children, that mindset comes naturally. So we're already thinking about legacy, about what we leave behind. Our elders understood this too. So parents and grandparents bought land, property or gold, not for quick profit, but to pass something down as dowry and or inheritance. It was about building a lasting foundation. So when we look back at early investors, like in gold, property, technology, or even Apple stock, people often say, if only I had invested then. Bitcoin gives us that same moment right now. It's the opportunity to plant seeds that will grow for our children's future. And that's why many of us Bitcoiners feel obliged to share the story. It's like the discovery or invention of electricity, the telephone, or the internet. You can't keep it a secret. You want to tell everyone because it changes everything. And for us as Muslims, it goes deeper. So sharing goodness is baked into our culture and our deen. The Quran reminds us the reward for goodness is nothing but goodness. So when we explain Bitcoin as fairness, transparency, and empowerment, we're not just talking about money. We're fulfilling a duty to spread benefit. And my hope is that by the time our children reach adulthood, they'll see Bitcoin not as a speculative asset, but as the natural foundation for saving and building. And if they've been raised with that framework, they'll carry those values into how they spend, invest, and even design future technologies, especially with the convergence of AI and robotics with Bitcoin and digital identity and what that could mean for current and future generations. So yes, instilling that long-term mindset in children is one of the most important parts of this work.
Yeah. And you know what I find interesting and fascinating is as you see and you know, this is what people forget, how critical monetary policy is to culture and the way people live, right? So if you consider someone who was born, let's say in the 90s or maybe the early 2000s, they did not have that type of training that the young kids had 50 years ago, and perhaps the kids will start to have now, mm-hmm. right? With Bitcoiner parents. And so we see that those kids, they were taught things like how to make money in the stock market. If you notice, there was a shift in culture for that period of time. And we saw that follow where they were spending and borrowing and diluting the currency further during those years, right?
Yeah, it really shapes the culture, like in terms of monetary policy. I mean, I think that's just like one of the fascinating things is that if, you know, you're living under a government that's printing a lot of money, naturally the money's going to debase, which makes people act in a more high time preference way. Yeah. But that also informs how the culture gets shaped, the culture that children grow up in, which kind of informs like how they go about life, which then is going to carry on to the next generation. So in thinking about Bitcoin, I mean, it's, yeah, like we're trying to get our children to think more in a low time preference way and more saving, less consumption now. Yeah. But in terms of that, I think one of the things that intrigues me about like watching my children grow up and as they interact with cyberspace and as they interact with Bitcoin is, do you think that Bitcoin or even Nostr in general, do you think this is going to have a role to play in how we conceive of digital IDs? Because to me, it seems like we're going to have some kind of way to, you know, figure out what's spam and what's not, what's real and what's not. And either we could outsource building that digital ID infrastructure to governments, which they're going to do that in very nefarious and very incompetent ways, or we can build those institutions ourselves. So like, how do you conceive of building something like digital ID when it comes to children interacting in cyberspace?
That's a really important question, MB. You're right. Monetary policy doesn't just affect prices, it shapes culture. So when governments print endlessly, people are pushed into high time preference, spend now, consume now, don't think long term. Bitcoin flips that by being a tool of low time preference, encouraging saving, patience, and legacy. Now, when we extend that mindset into cyberspace, digital identity becomes part of the same conversation. If our children grow up under a Bitcoin standard, they'll expect systems that are transparent, decentralized, and resistant to manipulation. That means digital IDs can't just be government-issued papers in digital form. They need to be community-anchored, cryptographically secure, and portable across platforms. So I'd imagine it as a blend of several key elements. For example, conceptually, just like Bitcoin wallets or Nostr bunkers, IDs would be secured by keys that prove ownership and authenticity. So it needs to have a cryptographic foundation. Communities vouching for each other. So identity isn't just maths, but reputation. We could do this via Web of Trust. Also a proof of personhood, like a way to distinguish humans from bots and AI without handing control to governments or centralized parties. And portability. So we need a standard that lets you carry the same ID across systems. So whether you're logging into a publishing platform, buying a home, or crossing borders. So for children, this is especially critical because they're interacting in cyberspace from a very young age. And we need systems that protect them while also teaching responsibility. So if we outsource this to governments and large corporations, we risk surveillance and incompetence. If we build it ourselves, rooted in Bitcoin's ethos of fairness and decentralization, we give them tools that align with our values, inshallah. So it's also important to note that digital ID for children in online spaces is double-edged. So it can enhance safety, but also risk surveillance and exclusion. I mean, Bitcoin and Nostr offer promising alternatives, but with caveats. Just as AI systems increasingly mediate children's online experiences, from chatbots to content feeds, digital identity becomes a gatekeeper, like who gets access, what they see, and how they're protected. For example, AI can filter harmful content, detect grooming, and personalize learning, but it also amplifies risks like algorithmic bias, data exploitation, and exposure to AI-generated abuse. And as you've no doubt seen in recent months, digital ID systems are being proposed to verify age, enforce parental controls, and ensure accountability. But it could also end up in mission creep, exclusion, and loss of privacy. So although I see Bitcoin and Nostr shaping savings culture and also inspiring how we conceive digital identity, we need to be careful about how we design, build, and adopt secure, decentralized identity frameworks that help our children navigate the digital world safely with trust and dignity.
Worried about teaching your family about money in today's world? What if there was a way to explore debt-free, riba-free, sound money principles with your kids? Introducing Bitcoin is Halal. Discover how Bitcoin as digital gold aligns with core Islamic values. No riba, sound money through scarcity, full transparency, and true property rights. Educate your family on crucial financial concepts through a fun, faith-filled adventure. Bitcoin is Halal. Adam and Layla discover digital gold. Available now from Ashiq Usman Books.
Yeah, that's actually what I'm interested in, which is the idea of taking it a step further than even Noster currently is, right? So thinking about it in terms of how can we take digital ID, create a sort of decentralized digital ID, but that's unified and that you can carry from one system to another. Now, I think it can be done using Noster. But that's something that I'm curious as to your thoughts on, which is imagine if you were to, you know, from scratch, create something like that, which you could utilize to travel, let's say. You could utilize to purchase a home or whatever it may be. But it also has a dual purpose, which is to differentiate within the digital world individuals from bots and AI, which is going to be a major challenge. If things stay the way they are currently, that would be a major challenge. So just your thoughts on that whole thing.
That's a fascinating question, T. I think you're pointing to one of the biggest challenges of our digital future. How do we create a decentralized identity that is portable, trustworthy, and human verified without falling back into centralized control? Noster already gives us a glimpse of this with public-private key pairs, the way you can carry your identity across apps without needing permission from a company or government. But to take it further, we need a unified framework where your digital ID could be used not just for social media, but for things like travel, property ownership, or even proving you're a real person in a world full of bots and AI. The dual purpose you mentioned is critical. It's not just about convenience, it's about differentiation. In a digital world where bots and AI can mimic humans, decentralized identity could act as proof of personhood. And for Muslims, or really anyone with strong ethical traditions, this ties back to values of honesty and accountability. So yes, I think Noster is a strong foundation, but the next step is building identity systems that are both trustless and culturally rooted. That way, they serve not just the technical need of proving who you are, but the ethical need of showing you belong to a community of real people.
That makes sense. That makes a lot of sense. But in order to do that, right, it's one of those things where something has to come first, right? Because if we think about at its core, this is just different systems being able to speak to each other, right? And then you giving the exact same power to, not maybe exact same power, but maybe, you know, certain percentage of verification powers to an institution versus a person's peers versus, say, a small business that they may have frequented, you know, whatever it may be, right? So I guess then the question becomes, what would be the first steps in actually getting something like that done or starting to move in that direction? I guess it would have to come from being able to transact, just being able to do business transaction, monetary transactions that link an ID in some way. Now, are you familiar with any specific protocols that exist that facilitate that and how they do it from a technical perspective, or does that still need to be created?
You're right, T. Something has to come first. And I think the foundation is already here in the form of Bitcoin keys and Noster keys. Both give us a simple but powerful primitive in the form of public-private key pairs. They prove identity and ownership without needing a central authority. Mm-hmm. The next step is building on top of those primitives with frameworks like the Web of Trust. That way, verification isn't just mathematical, it's social. So your peers, your community, even small businesses that you interact with can vouch for you. It distributes trust across layers rather than concentrating on one institution. So we know that Bitcoin offers immutability and censorship resistance, but it's not designed for identity use cases. However, layer 2 and layer 3 solutions could anchor decentralized identifiers or DIDs to Bitcoin's security model. Noster already supports public key-based identity. So every user is identified by a cryptographic key pair. But Noster lacks the robust moderation tools that would be essential for child safety. Neither system currently supports age verification, guardian delegation, or legal compliance, all crucial for safety. What we need is a decentralized, child-safe, parent-guided identity layer that doesn't rely on centralized databases. A wallet where your Bitcoin keys, your Noster identity, and your reputation proofs all live together, portable across systems. It may take some time before we get there, but we could iterate along the way. And that's exactly the vision behind a recent project I've started. And we could talk about it if listeners would be interested. So to answer your question, the first step is to anchor identity in keys and transactions, then layer on community-based verification. From there, we could have an identity and payment solution that can grow into a scalable, decentralized identity system that reflect both technical robustness and cultural values.
Yeah, I feel like it's one of those things that, you know, if you looked at the internet in 1995, I think all of you guys are younger than I am, but I actually was a kid at the time using the early internet. It was a completely different thing. You couldn't even imagine that we'd be doing this today. Well, you could imagine it, but you would not from a technical perspective. If you were talking to a developer at the time, they would look at you like, okay, come on, how is that going to happen? You know? So I guess what I'm saying is I think those things will be built, and I think AI will help in making that a more efficient process, right? Getting that done. We may be able to do it much sooner than it took for even the internet. I mean, it was only, you know what, a decade or so. The iPhone came out within 10 years of where the internet became mainstream, right? So it's one of those things. It could happen in 5 years. By 2030, we could have the infrastructure around Bitcoin. And look, if Bitcoin has value, which we believe it will, we believe that it will likely become the standard, then the ecosystem and the infrastructure will build around itself. It'll develop over time. Because anything valuable, the infrastructure automatically develops around it. But the difficult part is making sure that, because this is why I think it's a political problem, by the way. This is exactly why I think it goes back to politics, because it could be built around Bitcoin, but it could either be built by forces that are nefarious and forces that can, you know, if you live under a surveillance state, it doesn't matter if you have honest money underneath, underlaying it. You know what I'm saying? Like, if it's an explicit surveillance state, that doesn't even really, yeah, it'll be maybe a little bit better in some sense. The value of things might be good. But if you own nothing, right? If your ownership percentage in Bitcoin is nothing, essentially, it doesn't really matter to you. It's about who owns that supply. Right now, we have a pretty good breakdown. I don't know if you guys saw this chart, but this chart just dropped, I saw last week, which looks pretty new. It's about 71% are individual owners mm-hmm. in the entire supply. Yeah. Did you see that?
Yeah. I know the chart you're talking about, yeah.
To be honest, I think that number is probably lower. I personally think it's probably in the maybe 60. But still, despite that, that's a great start. Because those are the elites of the future. The current owners are the elites of the future. That's how we have to think about it. So therefore, it's good that it's spread out amongst more people rather than the current owners who own essentially the financial, you know, the services industries or own the real wealth, you know, gold, right? So it's definitely a better outcome. But the question is, how do we get to the best outcome, which is better governance around Bitcoin?
I think your comparison to the early internet is spot on, T. Back then, most people couldn't imagine the iPhone or streaming video, but the infrastructure grew because the internet was valuable. I think Bitcoin is on that same path. When something has real value, the ecosystem builds itself around it. And with AI accelerating development, we may see Bitcoin infrastructure mature much faster than the internet did. But as you said, the real challenge isn't just technical, it's political. Honest money under a surveillance state doesn't solve the deeper problem. So if ownership is concentrated or governance is captured by nefarious forces, then Bitcoin risks becoming another tool of control rather than liberation. That's why governance around Bitcoin has to remain decentralized and community-driven. The fact that 60 to 70% of supply is held by individuals is encouraging. It means the future elites are not just banks or governments, but ordinary people. The best outcome is to keep broadening that base, encouraging savings and adoption across families, communities, and small businesses. For me, governance isn't about creating a central authority over Bitcoin. It's about building layers of trust and accountability around it. Open source protocols, community standards, and ethical frameworks that align with our values. So the path to the best outcome is twofold. Keep Bitcoin ownership distributed and keep governance rooted in transparency and community rather than surveillance and centralization. That way, Bitcoin doesn't just become valuable, it truly becomes freedom money, inshallah.
Well, I mean, MB knows my view on this, which is I think there is a sense of urgency that we have because the world that's forming currently with all the forces in play, including, you know, the potential destruction of the fiat system, right, which is on the table. You can't deny that at this point. I mean, we can see it in the numbers. I mean, look at what's happened with gold. Look at what's happened with Bitcoin, right? So I think that it's critical that us, our generation, that we have a more leadership approach on this. You know what I mean? And try and build that up. So
Yeah. I mean, I think this definitely goes beyond just making sure that you have enough Bitcoin to pass on to your kids, because in general, you also want to make sure that they have the correct mindset going into the future. But in order to do that, you have to kind of understand what's happening around you, and you kind of have to understand what that solution to the problems that we are facing today, what that might look like in the future, so that we can better position our kids so that they are at the forefront and driving that solution so that it's aligned more with what we believe as Muslims. And so to that end, Mando, I also wanted to ask you, you've recently talked about this project you've been working on for making a Bitcoin wallet. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure, but I just want to say that I think you're both absolutely right. There is urgency, and it's not just about stacking sats for our kids. It's about shaping the mindset and building the infrastructure that reflects our values. That's exactly why I've started working on the Ijma Wallet project. It's still very early stages, but the idea is ambitious but also simple. It's to create a decentralized identity and Bitcoin wallet that's built from scratch, full stack, and open source. At its core, it uses the same primitives we already trust, Bitcoin keys and Noster keys, as the foundation for identity and transactions. On top of that, we want to layer in frameworks like Web of Trust, so verification isn't just mathematical, but also community-based. We're building it ourselves because we don't want to rely on proprietary third-party components. They could risk locking us into platforms that don't necessarily align with our ethics. By building Ijma Wallet openly, we can divest or boycott systems that compromise our values while giving families and communities a tool that scales globally. The vision is that Ijma Wallet becomes more than just a Bitcoin payments wallet. It's a decentralized identity wallet, something you can use to transact, prove personhood, and carry your digital self across platforms. And because it's open source, it's not just my project, it's something the community can contribute to, shape, and own collectively. So I've been focusing a lot on the architecture and design. We should have a clickable demo at some point soon, followed by an early prototype which integrates into Bitcoin, Noster, Cashew, and Fedi, and hopefully it'll provide an all-in-one solution, inshallah. For updates on the project, listeners can check out ijmawallet.com. For me, this is about leadership in our generation. It's important that we pass down Bitcoin and decentralized identity tools. That way, our children inherit not only wealth, but also the mindset and infrastructure to thrive under a Bitcoin standard.
That's such a great business idea. You should do it before I steal it. Because I mean, listen, a child-friendly wallet. I mean, we wouldn't do it as a piggy bank, of course. but maybe we would do it as like something else, right? And then you could send sats to it. That's a great idea. And I think it would sell. There'd be a lot of parents that would buy that for their kids.
Yeah.
So there you go, man.
Yeah. Man, I'm actually really excited. So for those that didn't catch it, what Mando was talking about is the Ijma wallet that he's been teasing out. Like you said, it's very much in early stages, but I definitely think initiatives like that are very needed in the Muslim space because, one, if we don't build the tools ourselves, other people will build it for us. So I think it's really good to take that initiative, but it also shows that for other Muslims, especially in more development-minded spaces, that they see that like, oh, okay, these Muslims that are into Bitcoin aren't just in it for the number go up. They're actually trying to build out the infrastructure for mass adoption for the Muslim Ummah. So I'm personally excited for it, and inshallah, we hope to get some more updates on the project. So I'm going to go ahead and wrap it up here. Thank you so much, Mando, for joining us. Alhamdulillah, this has been such a great episode.
As we wrap this up, I'd like to share a quick update on the Bitcoin is Halal project. So we have a Bahasa Indonesia translation that we managed to feature at the Bitcoin Bali conference in September. And more recently, the Arabic edition is also out, translated by Sheikh Muawiyah Tucker. He even wrote a brand new introduction for it, mashallah. All editions are available in both paperback and ebook formats. For more details, listeners can check out ashikusmanbooks.com. And we're also currently working on the audiobook version, and a Bosnian translation is also in development. So inshallah, the reach of this project is expanding across communities and languages, alhamdulillah. And for those who enjoy the characters Adam and Layla, I've also written a kind of sequel in the series focusing on AI. It's called The Robots Are Alive, Adam and Layla Demystify AI, and it uses the same characters to explore how children can understand artificial intelligence in a playful, story-driven way. Thank you so much for having me on the show, and I'm grateful for the thoughtful questions and the chance to talk about how Bitcoin, identity, and storytelling all come together for the next generation. Assalamu alaikum.
Reba Resistance is a production of Pod Systems and Bitcoin Majlis.